You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 166, Melchizedek, part 1A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. Better since getting back home. Things can return to the normal level of chaos, I guess, but I like that.
Yeah, back from Roswell. Did you see any UFOs when you were there?
No, oh, I saw plenty of UFOs. Yes. Sticking out of buildings and windows. Yeah. All that sort of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I was there for the 50th, and now the 70th has happened. It's amazing how fast 20 years goes by.
Yeah, so. That's true. But it was nice, you know, to connect with, you know, people that I'd seen there before. So everything from podcast listeners, not just Paranormal, but this podcast, all the way up to, I won't name them, friends who are on staff at Wheaton College and a few other highly respectable organizations. They're into the content, and I have met them before at Roswell. And I got to stay with a friend who's an FBI agent. So, hey, you know, that was fun.
Well, good deal. All right, Mike. You've got another trip coming up.
Yeah, basically 2 weeks from now, I'm going to be in Northport, Washington. And I've looked at Northport on Google Earth, and it's a really, really, really small town. I'm actually thinking about the possibility of having more people turn out for the event than live in the town. So it's got a few hundred people, but they're actually making a good effort to like do radio spots and promote it. So I imagine people from all over the place, you know, within a few hours distance, are going to come. And Fern and Audrey are going to be there with me. So this is their first, I guess you could call it, public appearance. And, you know, we'll just play it by ear. I'll have half the day on the 22nd, and we'll turn it over to Fern and Audrey for half the day. But you get to see them, and I'm sure it'll be interesting and fun.
Do you have any idea what y'all will be talking about and covering?
I'm just going to do divine counsel stuff. I'll probably... they asked me to bring along some reversing Hermann because, to quote them, everybody else, you know, that is going to come has already read the other book, you know, Unseen Realm. So I'll probably do a mix of divine counsel worldview stuff and then talk about content in reversing Hermann. That's my plan anyway. I think Fern and Audrey are just going to sort of, you know, wing it. They're going to take Q&A, and it'll be pretty interactive. So, you know, we'll see what, you know, what becomes of that, but it's the organizers basically have told me that it's going to be a combination of Christians who are into the content and lots of other people who are, I think, aptly described as curiosity seekers. You know, like, nothing ever really happens in Northport, you know, so people will wander in, and it could be a variety of backgrounds, but you know, we're kind of used to that. We don't have any problem with it, so I think it'll be fun.
Sounds good. Sorry, I'm going to miss that, but that sounds interesting. But what sounds interesting, Mike, is what we're going to be covering here over the next 3 weeks. Melchizedek, there's so much information to cover. I don't even know what you're going to do.
Yeah,
you got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, it's going to be three parts. You know, it might as well jump into it. There's just so much material about Melchizedek. And the reason there's a lot of material is because there's so many problems. There are so many points of confusion, so many points of ambiguity, so many things you can see in the text and then go down two or three trails and trajectories and really rabbit holes in this case, that it's a challenge to basically just cover it all, much less try to reach any sort of conclusions about a number of things. But we'll, you know, we'll do our best. We'll chop it up into three parts. And I don't think any of them are going to be short, but I know this one's not going to be short. So in this first part, we're going to focus on Old Testament material. So we're not going to get into Second Temple Jewish stuff. That's going to be part two. And then, of course, New Testament material, part three. But obviously, parts two and three are going to build on this one. And you're going to see, I can telegraph this much here, you're going to see how certain certain elaborations are made on the Old Testament material, and some would even use the word alterations, in Second Temple Jewish literature and in the New Testament. The Old Testament stuff is adapted in a number of respects by Second Temple Jewish tradition and New Testament. And that's not to say, and we'll hit an example or two today, that the New Testament or any of this other material is making stuff up. It's just that they'll seize on a particular trajectory and then kind of run with it or apply it in a different way that, you know, it could be a legitimate application, but you could apply it in two or three other ways too. So there's just a lot here that there is to consider. This is one of those topics that is kind of a vortex. A simple question like, who was Melchizedek? Turns into a dozen other questions, most of which don't have clear-cut answers. And I would say, again, this is easily one of the most complex topics in biblical studies. Let's just jump into the passages where Melchizedek is actually mentioned. We're going to start with Genesis 14. The other one is Psalm 110, but I'm going to stick here with Genesis 14, and we're going to spend a lot of time here. Then we'll pick up Psalm 110 at a certain point. So Genesis 14, 17 through 24 reads as follows, and I'm using the ESV. After his return from the defeat, of course, the person spoken of here is Abraham. After Abram's return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley, and Melchizedek, king of Salem or Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed him, that is, Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and said, Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself. In other words, the people that Abram had saved. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted my hand to the Lord, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share. That's the end of the pericope, the little section there in Genesis 14. Now, there are a number of issues that arise just from what we read, and really even just a handful of the verses that we read. Each has a bearing on how later literature, Second Temple Jewish literature, and New Testament material ought to be understood, or how they can be understood. And it has a bearing on whether the other literature reinterprets what's going on here in Genesis 14 in a manner consistent with the original Old Testament passage. Now, this in turn has a bearing on Christology. We'll eventually get there when we get to the New Testament material, and that'll actually build on some Second Temple material too. Since the book of Hebrews links Jesus and Melchizedek in some way, and that's a little vague for right now, but we'll eventually get there. And what I say in part three, I hope, will be sort of evident from what we cover in parts one and two. So for our starting point here, in Genesis 14, we're going to begin with the name, just the name Melchizedek. You think, well, what's the big deal about that? Oh, there's just a lot going on there. Now, in Hebrew, we have Malki Tzedek, basically two parts of the name. And I should note, I'm going to try to remember to do this for Brenda, who does our transcripts, that sometimes academic works will take Tzedek and write it, transliterate it, T-S-E-D-E-Q or E-K, or they will, instead of T-S, have S with a dot underneath. It's the T-S sound, T-S combined. And, you know, nobody follows the same convention all the time. So either one of those is correct. It's the T-S sound. So the name Melchizedek. Now, in the course of discussing the name, here's what we're going to hit. So just keep these things in your head. We have to talk about the type of name this is in terms of historical Semitic analysis. We'll talk about what the name means, and we also need to talk about the theology that sort of glommed onto or packed onto this name. And that's going to take us into the issue of Israelite religion. And that in turn is really going to be focused on the second half of the name, Tzedek, because I will telegraph this at this point and we'll eventually return to it. Tzedek is a deity name. It's the name of a god, a Canaanite god. And so that is going to factor into what we have here, what we're looking at when we see Malki Tzedek in Genesis 14 and elsewhere. Now, many presume that Malki or Malki Tzedek means king of righteousness, since that is a wording adopted in the New Testament. Hebrews 7:2 interprets Melchizedek's name, again, Hebrew, Malki Tzedek, as king of righteousness. And you can translate it that way, but the Hebrew is actually more flexible than that. Here are some questions to ask as we try to analyze the name. Is the name a Northwest Semitic personal name or not? If not, it might be a royal epithet, that is a title. So do we have a person's name here? Is Melchizedek, Malki Tzedek, is that a personal name? Is it actually the name of a person? Or is it a title? Okay, it could actually be either, and I'll explain why in a moment. Another consideration is, if it's not a name at all, again, and if it's a title, is there precedent for that view in the Old Testament, where you have something that looks like a personal name that might be a title? If, on the other hand, it is a personal name, is it a theophoric name or a descriptive name? Now, I need to unpack both those terms. Theophoric names are names that have a divine element in them, a deity name as part of them. So, you know, Malki Tzedek. If Tzedek is supposed to be understood as a deity name, then Melchizedek would be a theophoric name. One component of it would be a deity. Kind of like Jeremiah, Yermiyahu. You know, Yahu at the end is the divine name, Yah. Okay. Zedek, Yahu. Okay, we have all these sorts of names in the Bible that part of the name is the divine name or some other deity name. Is Melchizedek one of those? Or is it just merely descriptive? In other words, going back to Hebrews 7:2, king of righteousness, maybe Tzedek, that second part of the name, is not a deity name. Maybe it's an adjective, and therefore it's descriptive. My king is righteous, or king of righteousness. So there's all sorts of things, even with the name, to think about, and all of those things are possibilities. So let's take the name apart, as scholars would do, and start thinking about each of them. So we have Malki Tzedek, two parts. We'll start with the spelling. The New Testament King of Righteousness presumes that the name is what is called in Hebrew grammar a construct phrase. That means two nouns next to each other. There's noun X, and then there's noun Y. So you have an X of Y relationship, this noun of that noun. So in this case, it would be the word for king, Malk in Semitic. And then we'd have the word for righteous or righteousness. So king of righteousness, king of righteousness, noun of noun, X of Y relationship. So that's possible. Okay, it's possible. However, there's actually something that's kind of in the way of this. The first part of the name is Malki. It's a noun, M-L-K, plus a suffix, that little E on the end, the little I letter. You cannot have, by rule of Hebrew grammar, a suffix in between two nouns in a construct phrase. So it looks like that last little I letter, it's a yod in Hebrew. That shouldn't be there. It messes up the construct phrase. And if it's not a construct phrase, then, you know, what in the world's going on? It wouldn't be king of righteousness. It would be my king, there's the noun plus the suffix, Malki, my king is righteous, or my king is Tzedek, the deity. So which one do we have? You know, is it a construct phrase or not? Now, there's a way to sort of get around this. There's something called the Herek Compaginus, which is a sort of an arcane point of Hebrew grammar and syntax, that In most simple terms, the Y that is a suffix could actually be kind of a, you know, again, this gets so technical so fast. It could be the vestige of a case system. In other words, it may not be a suffix after all, even though 99% of the time when you have this little Y on a noun, it's going to be a suffix. There are apparent exceptions. And so you might have this little letter in there that messes up the normal construct phrase. It might be okay. It might not be a suffix after all, and you might actually be able to translate it king of righteousness. But odds are, again, that wouldn't be the normative way to understand the phrase. So, you know, what do we do with this? Well, let's just go back here and say, okay, we've got two choices where we're at right now in our discussion. King of righteousness, right now, if we just look at the name, that's possible, but less likely. And that means we don't have an X of Y, king of righteousness. We don't have that X of Y relationship between nouns. We have something like my king is, fill in the blank, either righteous or tzedek. So we either have a theophoric name where a deity is part of it, my king is tzedek, whoever tzedek is. And again, we're gonna talk about tzedek as we continue. You either have that situation or you have some description, my king is righteous. It's either an adjective, tzedek is either an adjective or a deity name. That would be the normative way of reading this. Now let's take the second one, my king is tzedek, for a moment. Tzedek is a deity. This is a known deity from Canaanite religion. And of course, Melchizedek is not an Israelite. He's not a descendant of Abraham. He is a Canaanite. So if we look at it as my king is tzedek, and we'll again talk a little bit later about who tzedek was and how can that be reconciled with the Most High? Isn't that Yahweh? Who's this tzedek guy? You know? So we have to address that. We'll return to it. We're just focused on the name here. If we take it as my king is tzedek, then we have something to, you know, not to worry about, but something to consider and try to parse. There are other names like this. Okay, there are examples of theophoric names in the Old Testament, as I mentioned. And a little bit of a wild card here: the first part of the name MLK, that's also a deity name from Canaan. So you might actually have two deity names here. You could have my king is tzedek, or if we take MLK as a deity name, you could have Melek or Malk. This isn't the way this wouldn't be Molech. Okay, that would be something different. But you have MLK is righteous. So we have an MLK deity known from Canaan, and we have a tzedek deity known from Canaan. So, you know, what do we do with all that? Now let's take a look at the Old Testament. I'll just give you a couple examples that'll probably, I hope, you know, sort of unravel the complexity here. You have names like Malkiel in the Old Testament, Genesis 46:17. That could be translated, my king, Malki, that's Hebrew for my king, is El. El is a deity name. You could also spell it or have a variety, a derivative, something similar as Malkiah. Okay, we have Ezra 10:31, Jeremiah 38:6. That would be my king is Yahweh or Yah. We also have names like Yehotzadak or Yotzadak. That would be the first part of the name, Yeho or Yo. Again, in Hebrew, I can't explain why Yo is still a divine name in a podcast, but either of those would mean Yahweh is righteous. Haggai 1:1, Ezra 3:2, you get those examples. And if you're paying attention, you might think, well, couldn't it also mean Yahweh is tzedek? Yeah, it could. Again, so what in the world are these people in the Old Testament? What are they thinking when they take these names? Were they names given at birth? Or are they titles later? Do they make theological statements? Are they titles that just sort of telegraph some belief that the person has? And we don't really get the true name of the person. You know, what's going on here? And again, all these things are possible with Melchizedek. It could be my king, you know, is righteous. My king is tzedek. It could be king of righteousness. It could be something like Malk is righteous or Malk is tzedek. It could be any of those five things just in this one little name. Another example from the book of Joshua, Joshua 10:1, Joshua 10:3, the closest example is Adonai tzedek. In Hebrew, it would be Adoni, my Lord, and then tzedek. Tzedek is my Lord, or my Lord is tzedek. Now, this particular guy in the book of Joshua, in Joshua chapter 10, verses 1 and verse 3, is the king of Jerusalem at the time of Joshua, okay, which at the time of Joshua is a Canaanite city. And Tzedek, again, as we're going to see a bit later, is a well-known Canaanite deity. So it makes sense for the king of Jerusalem at that particular time. Remember, Jerusalem is only going to become the capital of Israel when David conquers it. You know, we're not even near David's time yet. Originally, it was this Canaanite city. And so here you have a king that, again, is this really his name? Is this his name his mom and dad gave him, or is it a title? But either way, we know him as Adoni, my lord, is Tzedek, which would make a lot of sense given in context. Well, if it makes sense for him in the days of Joshua, why wouldn't it make sense in the days of Abraham, to have Melchizedek mean my king is Tzedek, Malki Tzedek? Again, taking on this name of a Canaanite deity, because he's a Canaanite. Again, he's not an Israelite. Now, I realize, you know, when you get into this discussion, you know, you look at this and you go, well, that makes me a little uncomfortable because, you know, in Genesis 14, this guy is supposed to be priest of the Most High God. And if his king is Tzedek, you know, Tzedek, then how in the world does that work? You know, what happened to El Elyon, God Most High, you know, the God of Israel? Who's this Tzedek guy? Again, these are difficult questions. And in today's episode, we're going to have to get into those things, but we're still, you know, at the name. So I'm not done with that yet because there are other things to consider here in relationship to what we've already said. Now, as far as, again, Adonai Tzedek, okay, just so that you fix it in your mind, because we're going to come back to this more than once, we have in him sort of a what some scholars would say is kind of a template example, a very convenient parallel. My Lord is Tzedek. He's in Jerusalem. That's in the land of Canaan proper. It's Canaanite territory. Again, Joshua's in there to conquer things, but you know he doesn't actually conquer Jerusalem because Jerusalem, by the time of David, is still not in Israelite control. David is the one who has to conquer it. So we could have a thoroughly Canaanite context for certainly Adonai Tzedek and very likely Melchizedek. So if we presume Melchizedek is a proper personal name, you know, it's probably theophoric. It's probably my king is Tzedek. Now, that we can't say that conclusively. It might be descriptive. It might be my king is righteous, and then, you know, referring to some unknown king that Melchizedek was, beholden to. We just don't know. But if we look at Adonai Tzedek as this sort of, you know, really convenient example, a lot of scholars are sort of steered into the direction because of Adonai Tzedek in Joshua 10. They're steered toward the notion that Melchizedek, and in Hebrew, Malki Tzedek, is a theophoric personal name. That this guy, again, is either given a name that honors the god Tzedek by his parents, or he takes it himself, and then it would also function as a title. Now, in the dictionary of IVP's Dictionary of the Pentateuch, Dictionary of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch volume, S.J. Andrews notes the following in this regard. So this is a short section from his entry on Melchizedek in the Pentateuch volume. He says, Melchizedek and Adonai Tzedek may have been Canaanite royal epithets. So he's going to try to defend the epithet view, that this is not necessarily a personal theophoric name. So here's the other side. E.A. Spicer has argued that Melchizedek is just the Canaanite equivalent of the Mesopotamian title Shar Mesharim, which means the just king or the righteous king. This would suggest that Melchizedek is a royal title rather than a personal name. The use of MLK and then Tzedek as a descriptive title is actually attested a few times in the Northwest Semitic world. A 14th century BC letter addressed to the king of Egypt discovered at Ras Ibn Hani, that's going to be an Ugaritic context, contains several royal epithets applied to the pharaoh. Included in this salutatory list are such titles as MLK, that's the word for king, again in Semitic. ML king, and then RB, Rav, the great king. And MLK Mitzrayim, king of Egypt. As well as the phrase MLK Tzedek, the just king. So that, again, to just to interrupt Andrews's little essay here, that's precedent, again, for taking this as a descriptive epithet, the just king. So here you have this guy come out to meet Abram. He's a priest of the Most High God, and his name happens to be Malki Tzedek, and it just means his name, his title is the just king, or my king is just. So it could refer to some guy we don't even know, rather than a deity. That's possible. But again, based on the analogy of Adonai Tzedek, most scholars gravitate toward the theophoric name option. But you got this is a legitimate possibility, even though it might be a minority view. Back to Andrews. He writes, the 10th century BC inscription of Yechimilk, king of Byblos, claims that he is MLK Tzedek, and then the conjunction and MLK Yashar. So that he is a just and upright king. So there you get the MLK Tzedek in that inscription from Byblos. Later in the 5th century BC, the inscription of Yechalmilk, also king of Byblos, contains the phrase, for he is a just king, a MLK Tzedek, just king. That's the end of Andrew's entry. So I think he marshals a decent amount of evidence there that the elements of Melchizedek's name might be a royal title, might be an epithet, might be some descriptive phrase about some guy that we don't even know who it is, because it wouldn't be the guy standing in front of Abram. See, he's a priest of the Most High God, and his name, again, would be honorifically given to him to honor his king, whoever that is. Or it could be a theophoric name. My king, you know, the guy who's standing in front of Abraham, his name is a theological statement. My king is the deity, Tzedek. Those are your two major options. Again, Hebrews 7:2, king of righteousness. You can sort of get there from my king is just or my king is righteous. You know, it's just a little, not a play on words, but it's just another way of saying the same thing. So the New Testament, you know, rendering of this isn't inaccurate. It just doesn't inform us about what the other options are. Now, let's go to, again, the way that this is described, because now we have another element here that might, again, make us gravitate away from one option and toward another. Genesis 14:18 actually does describe Melchizedek as a king. He is the Melech Shalem, the king of Salem, king of Shalem. Okay, so if he's the king of Shalem, and his name is Malki Tzedek, it's kind of weird because the guy standing in front of Abraham is a king. He's the king of Shalem. But his name, does his name mean my king is righteous? Well, if he's the king, who would his king be? Again, this is another reason why, even though this idea of my king is righteous, that it could be an epithet that refers to some other person, even though that's possible, it just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense if Melchizedek himself is a king, because then he'd have another king who's referred to as right. It makes more sense to have Melchizedek as a priest of the Most High God and a king of Shalem, and his name means my king is Tzedek. In other words, it's a theological statement. It's a theophoric name. This is why most scholars gravitate toward that view. Not only is it possible, not only does it have a good precedent in the Old Testament and in lots of other Semitic languages as well, which we didn't get into, but it also seems to make better contextual sense rather than the alternative. So let's talk about King of Salem, King of Shalem. You know, S and SH are kind of interchangeable here in Semitic, at least at this stage. We have here this description, Melchizedek is the king of Salem, or, you know, I'm going to try not to say Salem since that's such an anglicized pronunciation here, but Salem. Psalm 76:2, that in the Masoretic text, that would actually be verse 3. So if you're looking in Hebrew, you need to know that. So in English Bible, Psalm 76:2 places Salem in parallel with Zion. Let me just read you the verse. His abode has been established in Salem, his dwelling place in Zion. And again, if we actually click out to that verse, his abode, well, the prior verse is, in Judah, God is known. His name is great in Israel. So the hymn there, you know, his abode, being referred to as obviously the God of Israel. So Psalm 76:2 places Solomon in parallel with Zion, suggesting that Solomon is to be identified as Jerusalem. And you say, well, duh, you know, isn't that obvious? Well, actually, it's not, because you have some other things going on here. This identification is affirmed in the Targums, which are late, the Dead Sea Scrolls, again, which are also later than, you know, the Old Testament. That's intertestamental material. Also in Josephus and early rabbinic and Christian literature. They all, again, say that Solomon is Jerusalem, it's Zion, you know, six one half dozen of another. Now, in the Amarna tablets, Jerusalem is spelled Uru-Salem, possibly reflecting a combination of the Sumerian word for city, Uru, and the name Solomon. Now, in 397 AD, Jerome, again, the famous translator who gave us the Latin Vulgate, Jerome rejected the view that Jerusalem was Solomon. Of course, this is going to be, since it's Jerome, it's going to filter down into church tradition. He argued that the Genesis 14:18 referred to Salim, a town located in Samaria, northeast of modern Nablus. It is also noteworthy that Hebrews 7:2 appears to interpret MLK, okay, the king of Shalom or Salem, as a title. It doesn't interpret it geographically, because in Hebrews 7:2 we have the phrase king of peace. It doesn't say king of Jerusalem. It doesn't say king of Uru Shalom. It doesn't say king of Zion. It says king of peace. So here we have another problem. So not only do we have a problem with the name, and again, you know, Hebrews 7:2 can be in the ballpark. It saying that Melchizedek's name means king of righteousness is linguistically possible. It's unlikely that's what's going on in the Old Testament story originally, because Melchizedek is himself a king, and again, because of that, we sort of lean over, at least I do, we lean over to the theophoric name option, my king is Tzedek. So the writer of Hebrews doesn't get this wrong. He is taking one possible trajectory and sort of playing on it. And he does the same thing with this king of Solomon phrase, because he doesn't interpret it as king of a geographical spot, king of a particular city. He actually, you know, takes that phrase and translates it, renders it as king of peace. So we have both connection points in the book of Hebrews back to Genesis 14, obviously, because they're talking about Melchizedek, but we also have points of disconnect. You know, we have a sort of intentional use of these phrases by the writer of Hebrews, again, to make a certain theological point. I don't want to drift into the New Testament too much, but I want you to see that when we get to the New Testament, we're going to have to come back to, you know, this issue. Again, the name itself and this descriptive phrase, King of Solomon, aren't really precisely reproduced in the book of Hebrews the way people in the time of Abraham or in the biblical period when it comes to Israelite stuff, they probably would have read it differently than the writer of Hebrews does in chapter 7 of that book. Again, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. Let's talk about more on the Solomon-Jerusalem connection. I'm going to quote now from Anchor Bible Dictionary at length here, Philip King's entry on Jerusalem, because it's kind of interesting. It gives you, again, some of the backdrop here to the term. He writes, "A long history lies behind Jerusalem. It was the name of the city from early times. Jerusalem is mentioned for the first time in the Egyptian execration texts, which are 19th to the 18th centuries BCE, where the form of the name is probably to be read as Rushalimu. The name appears again in diplomatic correspondence, this time as Uru Shalem in Akkadian in the Amarna letters, 14th century BC, Abdi Khiba, a vassal of Egypt who was reigning in Jerusalem at the time, sent letters to the Egyptian pharaoh, Amenophis or Amenhotep IV, who was Akhenaten, affirming his loyalty, again, to the pharaoh. Later Assyrian texts also refer to Jerusalem. For example, in the records of Sennacherib's siege of Jerusalem in 701 BC, the form Ur-Salimu, or other variant spellings, appears. The name Jerusalem, Hebrew Yerushalayim, is of uncertain etymology. Although it is apparently of West Semitic, i.e. Canaanite origin, it appears to be composed of two elements. Yeru, Y-R-W, which means to establish, and Shalom, S-H-L-M, the name of the West Semitic god, deity, Shalem. Okay, so here we run into another deity name. Shalem is a deity in Canaanite religion. We keep running into Canaanite deities here, don't we? We have Malk, we have Tzedek, and now we've got Shalem. Again, that shouldn't disturb you because look at the context. We have Abraham, he's in Canaan. We don't have, we don't have the conquest yet. We don't have anything. It's Abraham. Okay, we don't have any of this territory under the dominion of Yahweh, the God of Israel. We have Canaanite location, and you would expect Canaanite names. And if people are naming things in Canaan, they're going to be naming things after deities because, hey, that's what you do. It's honorific. So we have here, again, it could mean Yeru, to establish, and then Shalem or Shalem, the name of the West Semitic god Shalem, patron of the city. The meaning, continuing now with ABD, the meaning may be foundation of Shalem, in other words, foundation of the god, the deity, Shalem, mentioned in a mythological text from Ugarit. Genesis 14:18 refers to Melchizedek as king of Salem or Shalem, likely Jerusalem. If so, this shortened form is the first biblical allusion to Jerusalem. In other words, if it really is Jerusalem, this is the first time it's mentioned. In Psalm 76:3, Salem, Shalem, is used in synonymous parallelism to Zion, referring to the divine dwelling. Joshua 10:4 contains the first specific biblical reference to Jerusalem, whose inhabitants were Canaanites. Again, in the days of Joshua, there it relates to Adonai Tzedek, king of Jerusalem, who formed a coalition with neighboring kings and attacked Gibeon. Joshua defeated them, but Jerusalem was not taken. According to Judges 1:8, the Judahites captured Jerusalem and destroyed it by fire. The text is historically, let's put it this way, the writer here, Philip King, says the text is historically unreliable. He doesn't take this as a historical statement. Because, he continues, Jerusalem was not conquered until the time of David. Well, let me just editorialize here. You can burn the city and not occupy it, okay? It's not real complicated. Back to the selection. Some Old Testament texts, Joshua 15:8, 18:28, Judges 19:10, so on, equate Jebus, J-E-B-U-S, the name derived from the pre-Israelite inhabitants of Jerusalem, with Jerusalem. How can you, again, this is me now interrupting. Wait a minute. How can you have Jerusalem and have this be Jerusalem? And who's this? What's this Jebus? Okay, the Jebusites, original inhabitants of Jerusalem. So how does this term fit in with these other ones? Well, King continues. He says, Jebus is the name derived from the pre-Israelite inhabitants of Jerusalem. Conveys the impression that Jebus, Hebrew Yavus, was the pre-Davidic name for ancient Jerusalem. The city was never actually called Jebus, though it had been a Jebusite settlement. The Amarna tablets attest that Jerusalem, not Jebus, was the name of the city. Nor does Jebus appear in other ancient Near Eastern texts, whereas, and we just read a bunch of examples, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, actually does show up in ancient texts. Despite the lack of extra-biblical evidence, King says, some would argue that Jebus and Jerusalem designate the same city. Others suggest that Jebus may be identified with Shaphat, situated slightly north of Jerusalem. So that's the end of King's entry. Now, Stephen Reed, also in the same publication, Anchor Bible Dictionary, in his entry on Jebus, says this, Some scholars have been troubled by this identification of Jebus and Jerusalem for several reasons. First, this identification is found in each case in a parenthetical note, which could be a later redactional, that is, editorial, or scribal addition to the text. Second, while the name Jerusalem occurs in the 14th century El Amarna texts and in the 19th, 18th century BC execration texts, no reference is ever made to Jebus. Third, Jerusalem seems to be too far south to be located on the southern border of Benjamin. While the Jebusites inhabited and controlled Jerusalem, this does not necessarily mean that Jebus was Jerusalem. Miller contends that the later scribes misidentified Jebus with Jerusalem on the basis of the Jebusite control of the city, and suggests that Jebus should actually be located at present-day Shaphat. If Jebus was actually used as a name for Jerusalem, it must have been a temporary name and must have existed alongside the older name, Jerusalem. So I read those two selections again to alert you to the fact, and to alert listeners to the fact that, you know, we're well aware here of the Jebus-Jerusalem issue. We're well aware of the Urushalom, you know, the focus on the Jerusalem name in other ancient Near Eastern texts. So we're not skipping any of the thorny details here on the podcast. We don't do that. But what it really comes down to is most likely, again, not because of the Bible or because, you know, we have something to defend here. It is most likely that Jerusalem, Urushalom, is the original name and the only name actually of the city. And Jebus could have been something, you know, very close to, you know, adjacent to it. And the people of that area moved into the city, took control of it for a while, and that's where the association came from. So back to Melchizedek. I mean, you've got him as king of Shalom, king of Salem, and that would make sense. Okay, that would be historically accurate because of what we just read. Back in the days of Abram, this place would have been known not as Jebus. It would have been known as Urushalom, you know, the city of Shalom or the foundation of Shalom. And again, Shalom is a Canaanite deity. So what do we have to this point? Let's just summarize a few things. We have somebody named Melchizedek in Genesis 14. He's both a king and a priest. So his name is probably theophoric. My king is Tzedek. Okay? Because we, you know, my king is righteous as a title, that would make this king, Melchizedek, referring to some other king, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We have a king priest then of a Canaanite city. The city is Salem, Shalom, Jerusalem, in, you know, for all practical purposes here, in pre-Davidic days, prior to the Israelite occupation under, you know, King David. We have a Canaanite orientation, therefore, and that makes sense in light of Joshua 10. And Adonai Tzedek being the king there. Okay, a little bit later, we still have this place under Canaanite control. That makes good sense, you know, historically. It's clearly a Canaanite name. And it's arguable that the name of the king of this same place, remember, Adonai Tzedek is the king of Jerusalem. And Melchizedek, you know, a few hundred years, whatever, you know, prior to him, was king of Salem. So he would have been king of the city. And then Adonai Tzedek is the king of the same city. And Adonizedek's name is My Lord is Tzedek. So again, we take that back to Genesis 14. It makes sense to have Melchizedek's name mean My King is Tzedek. Okay? Or Adonizedek is My Lord is Tzedek, excuse me. So you have two guys, likely king over the same place at different time periods, and both of their names have this Tzedek element in it. And it's a Canaanite context. So that's what we have to this point.
All right, that concludes part 1A. Be looking for part 1B next week. And also, I want to remind y'all that voting starts next weekend on the next book of the Bible that we will cover on the podcast. So please cast your vote. And also, if you don't mind, take time. If you appreciate what we do here at the Naked Bible Podcast, go rate us or leave us a review wherever you consume our podcast to help others find us. We certainly appreciate those who have already done so. And with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.